I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is comedic actor and writer and the junior United States Senator from Minnesota, Al Franken. He's joined in conversation by KALW station manager Matt Martin. And now join Warren Browner on stage at the JCCSF as he introduces Al Franken and Matt Martin.
It's true. Alan Stewart Franklin, United States Senator from Minnesota, is in the house. After a remarkable career as a comedy writer and performer on Saturday Night Live and in the movies, he hosted a progressive radio talk show on Air America, honing his political voice. Now in his second term, Senator Franken has emerged as a forceful challenger of the Trump administration, displaying his policy chops and asking tough questions during this year's cabinet confirmation hearings. As Karen Tumulty of the Washington Post wrote, and I quote, "At the dawn of a presidency that stretches the limits of late-night parody, and at a moment when an out-of-power Democratic Party is trying to find its voice, the former comedian and satirist may be having a breakout moment as a political star." He's also finding it safe to be funny again. Appearing in conversation with Al Franken this evening is Matt Martin, KALW's general manager. Friends, please welcome Senator Al Franken and Matt Martin to the JCCSF.
Thank you.
So, Senator, first I want to know, are you more or less depressed than you were when you finished writing this book just after the inauguration?
Well, it's about the same. I wouldn't say I'm depressed. I'm alarmed, worried, sickened. but I'm not depressed. I'm glad I'm one of 48 senators who can be a constitutional obstacle to not just a Republican Congress, but a president who I think is an anomaly and is outside the norms for human beings.
Okay, well then I have to ask. So, the Trump presidency so far, people have often characterized it as a train wreck, but it's a train wreck that seems to arrive with real regularity. And does that make it a little hard both to satirize and to challenge?
Well, I'm not in the business of satirizing it.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of glad I don't have to do that. I think that they've done a very good job on SNL doing sketches that are really funny but I'm kind of glad I don't have to do that. I'm really happy that I'm in a position to fight against some of the things they're trying to do. I mean, a lot of them are not Trump. A lot of them are the Republicans in Congress. And the current thing on the table is this health care bill in the Senate that is really just horrible. It's basically what it was designed to do was take away healthcare for the people who need it the most, to give a tax break to the people who need it the least. And there's something really, really wrong with that. In the book, I talk about, I dedicate the book to Paul Wellstone and Sheila Wellstone. And, you know, Paul had, among the things he said, was we all do better when we all do better. And I think that's what Democrats are about. I think that we believe the country is strongest when there's a strong middle, a middle class, and when people who can, who are aspiring to be in the middle class can be in the middle class. I think it works best economically. I think it works best socially when that's the case. And this has been something that has been hollowed out for 40 years or so. And so it's a, and it's a very, in many ways, this is a test of our country, I think. But, you know, when I come back, when we come back on Monday, I guess we're going to see what the Republicans, what Mitch McConnell has up his sleeve. And I can't imagine what it is. I was shocked at how bad this piece of legislation was. It seems like they...
It's not as if they didn't have time to think about it.
Well, you know, in one way, they didn't have much time to think about it because I think they didn't think about it all the time that Obama was president. They just kept attacking it without actually thinking about what they would do to replace it. And I don't think they counted on Trump winning. I don't think anybody did. I don't think Trump thought he was going to win. And I think they thought, okay, we're going to have Hillary and we'll you know, bash Obamacare some more. And but then suddenly they had to do something to replace it with, repeal and replace, which they've been saying they were going to do for, like, I don't know, the last 7 years. And they have nothing. They got nothing because I don't know, you know, Trump, when he said nobody knew it was complicated, which is just hilarious if you think about it. I mean, it really, it's more hilarious than sad, I think, because, you know, it says everything you need to know about him. And it kind of says pretty much everything you need to know about the Republican Party. They did not really think about this. And I don't know what they're thinking. I don't know if they understand. I have colleagues who will say, I had a colleague, I won't say who this is because it's very damning. He just said to me, well, you want to work together on health care. This is before this thing came out, and I am even before the 13 got together. And I said, sure. Can I ask you kind of what you know? Like, for example, there's been talk about allowing waivers for the essential health benefits. Do you know why that would undercut, in fact, destroy the protection for people with pre-existing conditions? And he didn't. And there are 10 essential health benefits in the ACA, and including things like, you know, pregnancy, having a baby. and if you say, well, we're not going to cover that, okay, well, then that's going to affect women, obviously. But let's say you say no mental health, you can get mental health and addiction coverage are part of the essential health benefits. Well, if you say you don't have to cover that, if you don't have to cover that, you don't have to cover cancer. Well, anybody who's had cancer and may have to have cancer treatment can't get that cheaper policy, which has excluded it. And someone who's had mental health history can't get that. So as a result, people with pre-existing conditions are just going to have to get more expensive policies. And that's how it used to be. That's what it used to be. And there were people who couldn't afford insurance. And this is why this is scored the way it is. And it's just, it's really, it's they are not doing their job. A number of my colleagues, they're not doing their job of understanding things that are very basic in whether it be healthcare or on education, on certain areas. Now, there's areas where we have disagreements that are honest disagreements, and I write about that too. And I write about how there's something called the 80% rule. It's not something called. Mike Enzi, Wyoming Senator, Republican, of course, says, well, there's like this 80%. He has an 80% rule, which is when you're legislating, Democrats and Republicans agree on 80%. If they just let go of the 10% on either side, you get to something. And I have a 64% rule. I just
you're
say,
being generous, maybe.
Well, just that 80% of the time, there's an 80% agreement. And so... And now, you know, and on certain issues, it's just there's no common ground. So on guns, they are just, or on climate now, there's very, very little agreement. And that I write about the Koch brothers, Siegfried and Roy Koch. And what they have... How, because of Citizens United and because of the Koch brothers and the unlimited money they can spend, the Republican Party is afraid, any Republican in the Senate is afraid to say that climate change is real and that we need to address it and that it's the existential crisis that it is.
So in your book, you really tell the story of this transformation of yourself from, you know, you tell your whole life story, the beginning of it pretty telescoped, and then really getting into how you became a public servant. And I think that one thing that really comes across in the book is you put in the time around the issues to dig in, understanding you can't dig into everything, but the things
yeah,
that
well, I
you
have,
deal with.
I right? am on four committees.
Yeah.
I'm on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, the HELP committee. That's one committee, which isn't that important unless you care about your
That's
health
tough.
Or your kids' health or your parents' health or your kids' education or your education or... Labor part is about if you want to work at some point. And the pensions part is if you want to retire. So that's one committee. And then I'm on energy and natural resources, which is where we get into the whole climate thing. And then I'm on judiciary, where...
Kind of by happenstance, right?
Well, yeah, you're... I did win my first one very narrowly, and it was delayed. It took 8 months to resolve. On the morning after the election, my opponent, Norm Coleman, was ahead by about 725 votes, which is like 0.03% or 0.02%. And he said that if I were Franken, I'd step back and let the healing begin. And then I won the recount. We have a hand. Every ballot is counted by hand. And I won the recount in time to be seated with the rest of my class. And that's when he took the anti-healing position. And he stuck with it for a long time. It's a long saga, which you see in the book, which I actually try to telescope, as you say, telescope in the narrowing of it, but capture the highlights. By the time I got to the Senate, Harry Reid, you get your committee assignments from your leader, and Harry was a majority leader at the time, and he said, you'd be great on judiciary. And I said, Harry, I don't know if you've noticed this, but there are a lot of lawyers in the Senate, and I'm not one of them. And he said, well, that's why we want you. We want someone with that perspective. And he was just BSing. I mean, he...
Is there any truth to it?
Huh?
From your experience, is there any truth to it, to having a non-lawyer on that committee?
Yeah, I'd say that it's good not to have everyone be a lawyer, but our chairman's not a lawyer. Chuck Grassley's not a lawyer. And our ranking member, Dianne Feinstein, is not a lawyer. I think Tom Tillis of North Carolina is not a lawyer. So it's okay. And I, you know, I have not found, by and large, every once in a while, I just don't know something because I'm not a lawyer.
So when you were describing one of your committees, the HELP Committee, and breaking that down, you know, you only care if you care about your health. It's a good example of why comedy is a little, humor is a little dangerous in politics, right? The transcript of that wouldn't I know it's a very tame example of it.
Yeah.
But you, in your race, your first race for Senate, you had to really come up against
my opponent, Norm Coleman, and the Republican Party put together a $15 million machine called the Dehumorizer, and it used Israeli technology, state-of-the-art, to take the context out of any joke. And when you do satire, you use things like irony and hyperbole. You even use ambiguity. And, man, if you strip all that stuff out, it looks horrible sometimes. And, there is one joke that I wrote in an article that I wrote about the future of virtual sex or something. And it was for Playboy. And I talked about how it was for the millennial issue of Playboy. So it was January 2000. And I wrote like how, you know, the internet has changed things, and I said, and how what a great tool it is. And I wrote a pretty conservative joke. I think at the end of this you'll agree, as you hear the whole joke, that it's a pretty conservative joke. And the joke was, internet is amazing learning tool. My son did a great sixth grade report last year on bestiality. He downloaded a lot of great visual aids, and the kids in the class just loved it because, you know, at that age, they're just sponges. And the point of the joke is that parents, maybe you should kind of monitor what your kids are getting on the internet. That's the meaning of the joke, but it turned into an ad, part of an ad where it was like, Al Franken told jokes about bestiality, and it goes like from infinity into your living room, through your eyeballs, rattles around in the back of your brain. And my mother-in-law cried when she saw that ad. And so that was what it was like. That was...
Well, those ads worked.
They did. They really drove down my, you know, approval, and, you know, and people thought I was a terrible person, or some people did. And so I write about that. And my wife, in an amazing, courageous act, said, you know, at a certain point she couldn't take it anymore. This wasn't her husband. And she did an ad. She had struggled with alcohol. And she did an ad about... you know, being an alcoholic, and I mean, I don't deserve a lot of credit for sticking with it or something, but I did write a couple movies about it. When a Man Loves a Woman, I co-wrote, and Stewart Saves His Family, which was a flop, but it both movies are used in at rehabs and family programs. But she did this beautiful ad, and there was a line in it that was we showed pictures of our family, and she just sat down and talked to our media consultant who was making the ad, and at one point she said, how could the mother of two such beautiful kids be an alcoholic? And it really spoke to the shame that alcoholics feel, and particularly to the shame that a mom feels. And 2 days after this ad aired the first time, we had a debate in an auditorium, and in a gymnasium, and the place was jammed full, And when she entered, she got a standing ovation. And it was really about, you know, a news anchor for the CBS affiliate said, you know, who would think that a campaign ad could actually help people? Because this was like an ad that basically, I know that somebody looked at that ad and went, you know, maybe I should go get help. And it was a remarkable, not only did I cry when I saw it, Chuck Schumer cried when he saw it. and I think Chuck cried because he said, now he's going to win.
No.
You're listening to comedic actor, writer, and United States Senator Al Franken, whose new memoir is Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. He's joined in conversation by KALW station manager Matt Martin on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Well, when you're talking about that, talking about the gymnasium debate, one of the great things in the book is really you get that sense of retail politics in a place like Minnesota.
Oh, yeah.
Much smaller state than California, obviously.
Yeah, well, California is...
it's a nation.
I don't know how you do retail politics in California.
Yeah.
You know, we have about 5.5 million people, and that's, I guess, about...
Still a lot to cover.
It's a big state, and it's not California, but it's not 40 million people. But here, I would imagine, it's so much is media, and you know, it's just a different animal. Most of us in the Senate have population. Well, everyone has a population much smaller than California, but there is something great about retail. In Minnesota, and I write about this in the book, we have the Democratic Farmer Labor Party, the DFL party. That's our Democratic Party. And kind of the organizing principle of the DFL are bean feeds. And they're not always bean feeds. They're spaghetti dinners or burger bashes, but we call them bean feeds. And they're basically the smallest either a county Democratic Party, a DFL party, or we have Senate districts. And I did not know if I wanted to really do this. We moved from New York. I brought my radio show to Minnesota. And I really badly wanted to beat Coleman. Two or three months after he was in, you know, Paul Wellstone and his wife and his daughter and three other aides and two pilots died in a plane crash 11 days before the election. And Coleman ended up winning. And then about two or three months after he was in office, Roll Call did a profile of him. And in it he said, to be blunt, I'm a 99% improvement over Paul Wellstone. And that's when I read that as the first moment I ever considered running for office. And I read that and I went, who's going to beat this jerk? Except that's not what I said. And that's no reason to run for the Senate, by the way, but it was, you know. And as it went on, it became less and less about Norm Coleman and more about the people I met. And one of the main things that I learned, you know, I had been having a radio show. I had a radio show for 3 years, and I'd been hearing from Elizabeth Warren, who was on my show frequently, and saying that at least more than half of all bankruptcies in our country involved a health crisis. And I saw, I knew that, but when I saw it going around Minnesota and would speak to people who that was happening to, or that was their fear, or it happened to their brother-in-law, or And then any VFW you go to or any cafe, you'd see a flyer up for a, you know, a barbecue for a family that had gone bankrupt. Mm-hmm. And the community was raising money for them to get health care. And that's because we had caps. And that's in danger here, too, by the way. They can do that. They can get rid of annual caps and lifetime caps. They're going to go back to pre-ACA. And
that's what they promised. Right? That's
You could repeal and replace with something. I don't know what it would be. I was kind of hoping they would maybe think that through. That would preserve the protection for people with pre-existing conditions, and that would continue to not have the annual caps or the lifetime caps. But I don't even quite understand what they're trying to do. I don't understand the rationale behind it. And this is why so many Americans hate this. I'm co-chair of the Rural Health Caucus in the Senate. I go around my state to hospitals and clinics and nursing homes and in the rural parts of my state, parts where they voted pretty heavily for Trump. They hate it. They hate it. Mm-hmm. And they know that there are going to be rural hospitals that close. And they know that if this happens, there's going to be more and more uncompensated care. This is why, you know, states that adopted the Medicaid expansion, rural hospitals do a lot better because they have much, much less uncompensated care. And we're going to see these hospitals have to lay people off. Very often in these communities, the hospital is the biggest employer. And in many cases, these hospitals are going to have to shutter. This is such a step backward that it really is painful.
I mean, you really give us, I got the sense from the book that going out, talking to people, you get energy from it.
Yes.
You get inspiration from it. It's something real. You get information. You really find out what's going on with people, and you get ideas.
One of the things that I didn't know if I was going to, it started off with really hating Norm Coleman. I admit that. That was it. And also loving Paul. And this was a big deal in 08, too. Which was I talk a lot about this, is like carrying that hung over the race, that plane crash, his death. And there was a little bit of Democrats asking the DFLers to put their faith in me was a heavy thing to do. And there were moments that I write about in the campaign where I wondered if I had let people down. That was tough. That was tough. But it more and more became about, and what I was going to say is I came back to the state, I started doing bean feeds, and I loved them. Mm-hmm. I loved doing them. And Jeff Blodgett, who had been Paul's campaign manager, he's one of the first guys I sat down with, and I remember him telling me, this is in like 2005, and he told me, like, just as an exercise, you should like write a 5-minute speech without any jokes in it. And I just thought, like, why would anyone want to do that? That's ridiculous, you know? So fortunately, that was 2005, so it gave me like 3 years to adjust to that concept. But so the first period that I went to was the 2006 cycle. I ran 2008. So I got to kind of be funny for 2006, and I really enjoyed it. But I really, really enjoyed, you know, you get a real sense for how decent people are, the basic decency of people. And, you know, very, it was good for me. It was good for me, and it was good that it turned into not about hating Ronald Coleman, although I still, no, when I finally won, he called and he was very gracious. And the next day I said to my campaign manager, you know what, I don't hate Norm Coleman anymore. And she went, I knew it. And I went, okay, well, give me a little time. But he's okay. He landed on his feet. He is now serves the people of Minnesota as a paid lobbyist for Saudi Arabia. But he's okay. Don't worry about him.
So when you finally got seated in the Senate, the work that your staff... I mean, one of the great things about the book also is you talk a lot about your staff.
Yeah.
You make it clear this is not... It's not a one-man show by any means.
Oh, my God, no.
And that continuing regulation of you, it's fair to say, that they have to do on a daily basis.
I went from their dehumorizer to our staff as a dehumorizer.
But at the same time, you did find some ways that humor is actually useful in the Senate. And one thing, I mean, you talk more about your Republican colleagues than you do about the Democrats in the book, and I'm sure there are reasons for that, but there's...
Well, the reason for that is I know my – I mean, I'm much closer to my Democratic colleagues because I spend more time with them and they think like I do. So I thought it was more relevant, you know, and then once I get started, I got to – you know, I have so many close friends in the Democratic side. But the Republican side, what I learned right away – first of all, I go there. I finally get in. And I know the Republicans are going to be kind of suspicious of me because I had used so much of my humor as a comedian and a satirist to heap scorn and ridicule on Republicans. Mm-hmm. So, but it took like a day or 2 days for them to go like, oh, I get it. He's funny and he laughs a lot. And so the first day I was there, I got sworn in. And Jim DeMint, a really right-wing senator at the time from South Carolina, then went on to head the Heritage Foundation, came up to me and said, how are things on the far left? And I said, they're great. How are things on the nutcase right? And we both laughed, and we were friends from then on, mainly giving each other crap. Lindsey Graham is really funny. No, he is. He's really funny. When he was in the primary, he was running like 15th out of 17. We were in the bathroom. We were in the Senate bathroom. I said, Lindsey, if I were voting in the Republican primaries, I'd vote for you. And he said, that's my problem. And... But there's one senator I write about, Tom Coburn, who really had no sense of humor, Tom. And Tom was referred to as Dr. No when he was in the Senate because he was a doctor. He was an obstetrician gynecologist. And he would put holes on things, and he was this extremely conservative Federalist. And, you know, that the states should do everything and the federal government nothing. So he would... My first three or four exchanges with him were we just missed each other entirely. So I went up to him, this is about 2 or 3 weeks in, and I said, Tom, can I take you to lunch? And he said, take me to breakfast. I said, okay. So we go about a couple days later, we go to breakfast in the Senate dining room, and it's about 8 a.m., and I say, look, you know, for the next 40, 45 minutes, whatever this is, let's just have fun, okay? You know, we can talk about our families, we can talk about politics, we can talk about our careers, but let's just have fun, okay? And he goes, okay, fun. And I go, right. I go, okay, careers, let me ask you this. to be a doctor in Oklahoma, do you have to have any formal education? And he says, yes, you've got to go to medical school. And I said, Tom, okay, see, that was a joke. See, and that's what I used to do in my career, with jokes. So
as a public servant, or as a person with a certain political perspective who wants to make change in Washington, why does that matter to be able to do that? Or why is that a valuable thing?
Well, with Tom, it didn't make a lot of difference, frankly. But no, it did actually. It means that you get a personal relationship. But let me finish the story because we had a fine breakfast. I taught him what a joke was and what the proper reaction to a joke is, and. And we had fun. And at the end of the day, we got a handwritten. I got a handwritten note delivered to my scheduler. He said I had a lot of fun. And so, I wanted to tell this story in the book. And I observed this thing where, basic Senate protocol and courtesy is that you don't tell about a private conversation you've had with another colleague. If it could possibly make them look bad, without asking their permission. I follow that rule with one exception, which is Ted Cruz. I have a challenge. But there's a reason I justify it in the thing, because he doesn't observe it himself. So I called Tom, and he's retired. He's in Oklahoma now, and I call him up. I go, hi, Tom. I go, hi, how are you doing? Good, good, good. You remember that breakfast we had? Oh, yeah. And you said that I said you have to have any formal education. Oh, yeah, I remember that. I go, okay, I'm writing a book, and I just wanted to, if I would like to have your permission to use that story. And he said, we have a First Amendment. You can write anything you want.
Common ground.
And I went, okay, I was just, I just didn't want to write it unless you, well, you're a gentleman, but we have a First Amendment, and when I write a book, I'm going to write anything I want. So that's an example of someone who didn't have a really strong sense of humor. But, it makes a difference. It makes a difference because my colleagues, look, let's face it. I'm, I don't want to say this, but I'm the funniest senator. And Amy Klobuchar, my senior senator, is funny, and Pat Roberts is very funny. And, Lindsay, again, very funny, and others have very good senses of humor. But there's a difference, between someone who did it for 40 years and thinks that way. And so it really does kind of make a difference.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features comedic actor, writer, and United States Senator Al Franken, whose new memoir is Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. He's joined in conversation by KALW station manager Matt Martin. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And the thing was, I could not be funny, publicly, but I could be kind of privately funny. And some in hearings, it didn't kind of leak out too much, although I tell a story about it. There was one early on, I was in a hearing in the HELP Committee, and this was the labor part, which is in about 30 states, you can now get married, LGBT couple, same-sex marriage, on Saturday and get fired on Monday for being gay or lesbian and or transgender. Anyway, so Jeff Merkley from Oregon had put forward an ENDA bill to end this practice, the Employee Non-Discrimination Act, and we had a hearing on it, and we had, and Harkin was the HELP Committee chairman, and we had a number of Democrats in the hearing. Tom Perez, that wasn't Labor Secretary at that point. He was Civil Rights Deputy Attorney General for Civil Rights. Not one Republican shows up. And I'd never seen this before. Usually the ranking member just shows up, and at least. But not one Republican. So I'm sitting, I haven't been there long. I'm sitting at the end. I'm the junior, most junior. And I think of like, and the whole room is filled with LGBT activists who are behind, just there to view in the hearing room. And I think, what if I said, I think it's a shame that none of the gay members of the committee showed up? And I had a lot of time to think about it because I had, and I was driving myself crazy. And I write about it. The devil on my shoulder was going, "Tell it, it'll kill." And the angel's going, "Now, Al, you know why you came here? To help people, to improve people's lives. It's not going to help them. Oh, come on, it'll kill." So it was very intricate because the devil got his own angel and devil, and the angel got his own devil and angel, and the angel's devil and the devil's angel worked it out.
One of those back
they did good staff work, but that's from a chapter called "The Angel and the Devil." Enjoy it.
But with this book, clearly you're feeling a little more comfortable.
Yeah, no.
With being able to, and what is that? It's just because you're in your second term.
Well, won the in 14. I won by about 10 plus points, and it was because I think the people of Minnesota got it that I was that I was a workhorse, not a show horse, and that I was accomplishing things and had run like. They got that I wasn't who I was depicted in those ads. And so once that happened, I felt like, okay, my time in comedy purgatory is over. I can be funny. And then the reason I wrote this book, what got me started on the book was I was supposed to have a 5-day vacation with my wife in northern Minnesota at a lodge, and she got sick. She was in D.C., and she just said, "You take it by yourself." So I had 5 days alone in a cabin, and it could have been The Shining. You know, I decided to write about all this, and it turned out to be a lot of fun. And actually, it sort of helped me think about, how I approach my job. When Trump won, and I said, "Okay, the book is now going to have to be different," and I just started thinking about how Trump happened, and relating it to the earlier stuff in my book. I'd written a book in 1995 called "Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations," and that was about two things really. It was about talk radio and the breakdown in the civility of our discourse, and about Newt Gingrich and what he did. And he had taught his Republican candidates to learn to talk like Newt, And you use word like traitor when you're talking about you're and sleazy and corrupt and just the nastiness of that, which has gotten just worse and worse and worse. And Rush was a lot about lying, just how the ability to just lie and how that was seeming to work. And then the next, you know, then I wrote Lies and Lying Liars Who Tell Them, A Fair and Balanced Look at the Right, and that was about Fox and the kind of the right-wing media. And, you know, that was really pre-the internet era. And now we have, you know, people in America seeking out information from places and places are happy to provide it to them that just corroborate their own bias. And so there is this this disturbing alternative fact universe where just any you can say anything, and now we have a president who calls the press the enemy of the people and just says CNN is fake news, New York Times fake news, and a certain amount of people buy it. And it's very dangerous.
I want to end with something a little more inspirational, as you do in your book. Talking about Muna Abdullahi.
Oh, that's a great story. I mean, that's a great thing to end on. That's why I ended the book. Thanks for bringing that up. A few years ago, like 2-3 years ago, I got I'm in my office, and I said, we got a new group of pages. And there's one from Minnesota, and she's from Wilmer, Minnesota. Wilmer is in South Central Minnesota, and it's in Canajoharie County, which is the largest turkey producer in the state, and Minnesota's the largest turkey producer in the country. And so, and she's a Somali girl, Somali Minnesotan. Her name is Muna Abdullahi, and she, her principal recommended her to be a page. And she did a great interview, and she wrote a great essay, and she's here with the new page classes here. There's 30 pages, and so we don't always get a page. And I went, well, I want to go down, I want to meet her. So I go down to the floor, and the pages are there, and it's really easy to pick her out. She's Somali, she's wearing a page, you know, her page uniform, but she's wearing her hijab, her headscarf. So I go up to her and I say, you look like a Minnesotan. and she smiled and said, yeah. And so I met her there. And she was very poised and very lovely and smart. And so, you know, when the Somali ambassador, we had a new Somali ambassador who came to the Senate to talk to the senators from states that have large Somali populations. I bring her along to be in the meeting so that the ambassador from Somalia could see that we have Somali Minnesotan as a page. I wanted him to see that. And so last June, not this past June, but in June of 16, you're a junior when you're a page. And so she graduated last year from Wilmer High School. And I invited myself because she was the class speaker. She'd been chosen to be the class speaker by the class. And I write about this because it's a chapter called Being as Good as the People You Represent. And it was such a tonic to this election. This was last June, it was a year ago. And there were, I think, 236 members of the class. And I get there, and, well, beforehand, I saw Muna, and she gave me a big hug. So anyway, I get there, I'm up on the platform, and I look at the class. And there's 236 kids. And I'm just looking by the names. I can see like 60, 65% are your standard white Minnesota Scandinavian German names. And the president of the class was Tate Hovland. And I asked Tate, and he was half Norwegian, half German. And about 15% or so were Latino. And Meta Marin Mera was the valedictorian. And she had been born in Ecuador. And there's a big Genio meatpacking thing there. This is why a lot of Hispanic kids, people, folks are there. And then about 10, 15% were Somali. And Muna was chosen as a class speaker. And I invited myself so I could introduce her. And it was the nicest 2.5 hours, the best 2.5 hours that I spent last year. And Trump had come into Minnesota just once to speak in right the Sunday before the election. And he came in, landed at the airport, and he just tore into the Somali Minnesota community in a way that was just ignorant, just hateful, awful. And I thought back to this. So, first of all, they have a really good orchestra, the Wilmer High School. And so, and they have a great chorus. They every year they do the Battle Hymn of the Republic as their finale, and it was the most stirring rendition I'd ever seen of that. So when they start, they do pomp and circumstance like any high school, and they have a middle aisle, and Muna Abdullahi, A-B-D, she's first in the alphabet. And so Muna comes down like this, holding hands with Michelle Carlson. They're holding hands. And there's my driver around the state, he and I have this thing called couldn't be cast better. And every once in a while you meet a soybean grower who you just, Hollywood could not cast a better soybean. Michelle Carlson was the half of the Carlson twins, Mary and Michelle. And you could not have cast the Carlson twins better. They were on the thing, it had asterisks by the kid whether they graduated honors, high honors, or highest honors. Both the Carlson girls had graduated highest honors. And they were tall and emanated this positivity and love and light. I mean, just, it was crazy. and they're just walking down holding hands to pomp and circumstance. And they go to their edges. And the whole thing was like that. Tate gave us a nice speech. Meta gave a great speech. And then I got to introduce Muna, and she got this huge ovation, and she gave the speech, and she got a standing ovation. Great speech. And then at the end, after the most beautiful battle hymn of the Republic I've ever heard, my job was to take pictures. They get handed the diploma, and I was going to take pictures. And so Muna was first, and they said, like, okay, hold your applause until the end of this. And so they announced Muna, and the whole place goes nuts. And the kids were doing this on the bleachers, the other families. And this was a town that friggin' works. I'd been there the year before because they had an avian flu outbreak. And a lot of the growers thought they might, producers thought they may go under. We got some federal aid for them, got some federal help to, they had to kill their flocks. They had to do certain things. You know, I don't know whether these producers, these turkey producers, are Democrat or Republican or independent. I don't know. I don't care. I will never care. My job is to do stuff for them. I represent Minnesota. And do they want Muna's dad there? You bet. Muna's dad does IT for the Jennie-O store. They want Meta's family there. That's America. So on election day, I go to the University of Minnesota. Muna's at the University of Minnesota now. And I see her there. There's 40,000 students at the University of Minnesota. I see her, and she tells me that her sister, Anissa, was voted homecoming queen. Yeah. And I have a picture of the moment she's crowned over her hijab. And about a week after the election, I'm back in D.C., and I meet with the French ambassador to the United States. And he's in my office, and I say, what do the French consider a Frenchman? And he said, most French consider a Frenchman somebody who can trace back a couple hundred years to the village that their French village that their family is from. And I said, so your immigrants aren't considered Frenchmen? And he said, not by a lot of Frenchmen. And I go, and you don't do a lot of assimilation. You kind of segregate. And he goes, yeah. And it made me think of Paris. And it made me think, that's what they do there. We vote them homecoming queen. That's who we are. And, you know, we're so much better than this president. We are. Well, that was the Jewish version of that.
So, thank you so much, Senator Franken.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was comedic actor, writer, and United States Senator Al Franken, whose new memoir is Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. He was joined in conversation by KALW station manager Matt Martin. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, Maya Finley, and Jake Gukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.